Hi, welcome to this week's program. The world we live in today is very different from what our planet looked like millions of years ago. The plants, the animals we see around us and take for granted, in fact, are survivors that learn to adapt and win as the world around them changed. In a similar vein, much has changed in the world of finance and investing over the past 50 years, yet most of us still find comfort in time-tested investment rules. So it's always good from time to time to analyze the ground we stand on and see if old rules still apply. After all, that is the essence of innovation and growth, our ability to constantly adapt, to change, to evolve, survive, and win. Else we risk becoming evolutionary statistics that did not make it. So in that spirit, I've been pondering how my professional world of finance and investments has changed over the years and what we need to do differently to succeed in our investments going forward. As I did my thinking and research, I came across a pretty relevant article in the U.S. News some time ago. The article by Joanne Cleaver is titled 10 Common Investing Rules That Don't Apply Anymore, which I plan to share with you today along with my own ideas and thoughts. Old school rule number one, which I think many of my older listeners might recall, is it goes something like this. The percentage you should have in stocks is 100 minus your age. The new rule? Rebalance your portfolio to grow consistently. The idea behind the old rule of 100 is that the younger you are, the more risk you can tolerate. That makes sense. But technology, computer-based algorithmic and automatic trading, greater capital flows and liquidity, and so on, have changed the ways markets now move, very different from 30 to 40 years ago, before the widespread adoption of technology by Wall Street. And as the market crash of 2008 proved, recovering a 30% loss is not gaining 30%, but gaining 50%, because you're rebuilding from a shrunken base. So investors need to react to a harsher trading environment and rebalance portfolios more frequently to meet investor goals. Old school rule number two, retirees should be in bonds. New rule, retirees need growth. In the past, bonds used to pay reasonable rates of interest that were typically at or ahead of inflation, so most investors found safety with bonds as they grew older. But with the ultra-low interest rates that we've had for the past few years, bond returns bear much higher interest rate risk, haven't kept up with inflation, and have fallen well short of equity investments. So bond-oriented investors need to reassess their strategy and consider keeping a slice of their portfolio in growth investments. Old school rule number three, count on an 8% compounded growth rate. New rule, you probably can't count on it, at least if you have a balanced portfolio. Just do the math. With today's 5-year treasury yield at less than 1.4%, and assuming equities deliver 6% per year, a portfolio that's half stocks and half bonds will earn slightly less than 4%. That's about half of the 8% rate, and assume stocks will perform reasonably well. So investors need to recalibrate their return expectations in this dramatically low interest rate environment and consider saving a lot more while also increasing their exposure to equities for long-term growth. Two caveats, of course. First, with inflation running at a little over 1%, a 4% return will still create real wealth. It's essentially the same as earning 6% in a 3% inflationary environment. The net return after inflation, which in both of these cases is 3%, is really what matters. Secondly, with solid equity gains over the past 5 years, there's always the risk of a disturbingly violent near-term correction. But as history has repeatedly shown us, over the long run, investors that stick with equities typically do well. Old school rule number four, in retirement, you can live on 75% of what you need today. New rule, it's more like 100%. When you first retire, you want to do everything you've always dreamt of. Move to sunny Florida, take a vacation, golf 3 times a week, go fishing, and so on. But all that takes a lot of money. So you do typically sink into your savings in those first few years of retirement euphoria. Then life slows down a little bit, but medical costs may pick up. Inflation marches on regardless and keeps eroding your buying power. And these hard truths shatter the delusion that you can live more cheaply in retirement than you do now. The truth probably lies somewhere in between. So just knowing and being prudent will help you manage through this uncertainty. Old school rule number 5, withdraw 4% annually from your portfolio. New rule? Sure, if you'd like to guarantee that you'll go broke. It used to be that the 4% rule would stretch your money over 30 years, but that assumes a 50% allocation to stocks, which many retirees find too risky. So the old 4% withdrawal rule is crumbling in today's merciless economy. A safer initial withdrawal rate today, assuming a 50% exposure to stocks, minimal investment fees, might be 3.2 to 3.5% for a 30-year horizon. What greatly helps your portfolio here is if you reduce the fees you're paying by going with low-cost funds and reasonably charging advisors that act like fiduciaries who place clients' interest first ahead of their own fees. Old school rule number 6, for a comfortable retirement, $1 million is the number. The new rule, try for $2 million to breathe easier. People used to think that if they had $1 million, they were set, but with improved healthcare and living standards, lifespans have increased significantly. So if you retire at 65 and live another 35 years, $1 million just won't cut it. To net $5,000 a month after fees and taxes, you'll have to pull out $75,000 a year, or 7% of your $1 million, and that's not going to make that million last too long. So definitely increase your retirement savings just to be on the safe side. Old school rule number 7. You probably can retire on the income numbers projected on your 401k statement. New rule, don't coast on the wisdom of footnotes. Projections included in the 401k statements are sort of dangerous because they don't take into account real-life variables, yet people fixate on these estimates and lull themselves into a false sense of comfort about making it through retirement. The reality is, you don't know how they arrived at that number, and it's best that you consult a financial advisor and model your portfolio goals on data that's new and relevant. Furthermore, life is ever-changing, so a snapshot of projections will go out of date very quickly. The trick here is to treat these numbers like a GPS system, like in your car and you're traveling from one destination to another, constantly updating with new, relevant information. A good financial planner understands this and is constantly updating the numbers at the very least, annually. Old school rule number 8. Compound interest is magic, invest early, and watch from your easy chair as your investments grow. New rule? Compound interest sure helps, but experts rarely calculate the compound deflating inflation, fees, and taxes. Now, I am a firm believer in the magic of compounding, but as I have repeatedly cautioned, inflation, fees, and expenses can sizably reduce the benefits of compounding. So again, do all you can to reduce investment fees and expenses, factor in recent rates of inflation and expenses, as I said, and come up with realistic investment goals. Now, compounding does create some crazy math. If an 18-year-old invests $2,000 a year until age 26 and then stops investing, he or she will end up with $2.28 million by age 65. If he waits until age 27 before making his first $2,000 investment, and then he invests $2,000 a year until age 65, he will only end up with $1.5 million. So again, starting at 18 and ending at 26 is better than starting at 27 and investing until age 65. The math is crazy, but true nevertheless. All right, old school rule number 9, I can retire on my inheritance. The new rule? That only works if your parents die on schedule and don't leave a pile of medical, legal, and other bills behind. Now, this is for folks who think their parents are millionaires and will leave them with enough, and don't consequently think they need to worry about retirement investing. But parents can live longer than you expect, or get hobbled by costly medical expenses, or have a falling out with their heirs. Fortunes can and do disappear overnight, even in the best cases, so don't take anything for granted. Rich or less rich, do all you can to independently build a nice little nest egg. Moreover, if you save independently, you will have higher self-esteem and happier relationships with your parents, siblings, and everyone else. And finally, old school rule number 10. Formulas work. They're math, aren't they? New rule? Simple math yields simplistic results. The real world is far more complicated. As I mentioned at the beginning, traditional wisdom is based on historical returns over several mid-century decades that, in retrospect, were remarkably drama-free. But lately, the frequency and adverse impacts of bubbles and crashes have been a lot more destructive. So, adapt to this new world. Don't bet on your own smarts to beat the market, and take advantage of automated systems such as target date funds to stay ahead of the investing game. Listening to the Steve Pomeranz Show. You know my next guest. His early career as a con man and swindler was made into a major motion picture directed by Steven Spielberg and his character played by Leonardo DiCaprio. Can you guess the movie's name? Well, the answer, of course, is Catch Me If You Can, and the con man was Frank Abagnale. Now, Frank joins me today to discuss his new book, Not Catch Me If You Can, but Scam Me If You Can, Simple Strategies to Outsmart Today's Ripoff Artists. And I'm so pleased to welcome him to our program. Hey, Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Steve. Glad to be on.
You know, it's important to state up front that you turned your early years of crime into a legitimate career, lecturing around the country, training FBI agents, assisting the FBI when they called on you, and you were a trusted FBI person for more than four decades. What have you been doing of late?
Basically the same thing, you know, that I did before the movie. For the last 43 years, I've taught at the FBI Academy, taught two generations of FBI agents. I, of course, have conducted more than 3,000 seminars around the world for corporations, financial institutions. And in the last 5 years, I've spent some time with AARP, helping them deal with crimes against seniors. They, of course, have 38 million members, and they're concerned about things like scams and identity theft. And so that's how the book came to be, from the relationship with AARP.
Yeah, that's actually how I found out about the book, receiving literature from AARP and seeing your name and seeing what you were doing. And then we reached out to you. Now, when you were first washing checks or whatever you called it, I mean, that was a different world back then. And I mean, and you were really above the average in the sense you pretended to be a pilot, you pretended to be a medical doctor, all of those wonderful things in the movie. But your main con was writing bad checks. Now, the world has changed just a little in those 43 years. It's a lot more complicated now, isn't it?
It is, but it has made crime 4,000 times easier than when I did it 50 years ago, because I didn't have all of the technology that exists today and the ability to do it from thousands of miles away. But certainly I've had to change over my 43-year career of learning all these new crimes. I mean, when I went to the FBI Academy, there was no cyber crimes, no identity theft, no phishing emails. None of those things existed. And crime is changing constantly, so you have to constantly keep up with crime, and I've had to do that my entire career. But the one thing that I've realized is that the criminal hasn't changed. The methods, the personality of the criminal is the same. It's just that the technology the criminal has that they use today has changed completely.
Well, you know, in the book, you talk about the techniques that con artists use, and one of them is the art of putting your victim under the ether. What is that?
It's absolutely just the ability to get into someone's, to believe in what you're saying and that you are who you say you are. And the truth is that the majority of people are honest, and thank God they are. But because they're honest, they don't really have a deceptive mind. So when the phone rings and the caller ID says that it's the police department, they truly believe it is the police department because no one's told them differently. Mm-hmm. And then when the person says they've arrested their grandson for DWI and they tell you what kind of car he was driving, he had a passenger in the car and what her name was, But he asked us not to call his parents. He asked us to call you, and he has to post bail in the next couple of hours.
Yeah.
Or have to spend the weekend in jail. Of course, the grandparent immediately, well, how do I do that? Well, you can give me a credit card over the phone, and we'll post the bail.
Mm-hmm.
And unless someone's walked you through that and explained the grandparent scam to you, you would truly believe it's legitimate, because they go to social media where the grandson has showed his car on a picture of it, has his girlfriend's name and a picture with her,
yeah,
has his family's name. So the things they're telling you have so much credibility, because we live in a way too much information world where we tell everybody everything about us and then wonder why they can answer all the security questions and they can make it sound so real.
It's also very insidious, because the way they speak to you once they have a couple of phone calls, not in this particular case where they're calling you and it's a matter of urgency and you have to act now, but a lot of people get these phone calls where at first they don't trust, but they know just enough about the person where they can kind of become their friend and then very subtly get them to divulge, you know, how much they pay up for their mortgage, you know, what bank they use. It's more subtle than that, isn't it?
Yeah, and what's real scary, I think, about it is, you know, 50 years ago, there were con men and con women, and of course, that stood for confidence man. And basically, that was an individual who had to deal with you one-on-one, and he had to be in front of you. So he dressed well, he had a great vocabulary, he looked and spoke very well, and he was very friendly and likable. And he, of course, being a human being dealing with another human being, there was some emotion involved and some conscience involved. So, you know, he may have said, I'm not going to take this person for all their money because he's a nice old guy. I don't want his house and steal all his money. I'm just going to steal some of his money.
Yeah.
The difference today, that individual is sitting in a kitchen in their pajamas with a laptop and a cup of coffee in Moscow, in India, in China, in Jamaica. They never see you. You never see them. There's no emotion. There's no conscience. There's no compassion. They will steal from you every single penny you have. And that's the big difference between now and 50 years ago.
Years ago, I would read books on sales techniques, and they talked about certain types of techniques which create more sales. And you in your book call them hitting the buttons, using scarcity or urgency or flattery as a way for these people to get to you. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, I used to tell people all the time that if you show me a great salesman, or you show me a great marketing individual, or a great public relations individual, they basically have the same personality as the con man, the same talents, the same abilities. The only difference between the two is one stays on the right side of the law, and the other one crosses over that line between what's legal and illegal. But the personalities are the same. They know to use the flattery. They know to use the urgency. They know how to get under your skin and get you to buy what they want to sell you or convince you that they're telling the truth. It's the same thing. It's just one using it in the right way, one using it in the wrong way.
Let's talk about those people who are calling us day in and day out from numbers that are not 800 numbers. They're not private phone numbers. They're actually numbers from people that we think we might know. It may say Frank Abagnale on there or Steve Pomerantz as the caller. And, you know, we're talking about robocalls. What is the current state of the robocall issue?
Well, and robocalls, you know, when we look at companies like AT&T and Verizon and companies like that, they're about 30% of where the robocalls come from. The majority of the robocalls are generated through these private phone companies that are all over the world in places like Jamaica, where they're very small businesses and they make a lot of money off of these robocalls, and they're able to use these calls for every possible thing that you can think about. And of course, the spoofing of numbers is very serious because, for example, if it comes up on the caller ID and it says the number for Social Security, and then I get you on the phone and maybe you're a little bit reluctant and I say, look, Mrs. Jones, if you don't think I'm from Social Security, you see the number on your phone that I called in on.
Yeah.
Go to the phone book and look up under federal government Social Security and you'll see I'm calling you from the same 800 number.
Right.
And that's very convincing. And I can make it be your daughter's phone number, your number, the person next door's number. So again, unless someone knows this, it's very easy to convince people that it's real. And that's why In my entire career, I believe that education is the most powerful tool to fighting crime. If you educate people and you say, here's the scam, here's how it works, and here's how they forge checks, and here's how you tell whether they're altered or they're counterfeited. If you explain to people and they see it, they're smart enough to protect themselves, but they need the tools, they need to understand how that's happening. And that's why I was commissioned to write this book by AARP. I didn't receive any advance or royalties from the book. It's their book. Mm-hmm. But they wanted to make sure that I covered every type of scam involving millennials, involving seniors, involving investment people, so that people understood these scams happen to everybody.
Let's talk about the things that you can do when you receive, or that you should do when you receive a robocall. I'll start it off. First of all, don't answer the phone. That's in your book. Don't answer the phone. Don't pick up the call. Why is that?
Well, because a lot of people have a message receiver or phone that they get messages on, and they can hear the, I would just not answer the phone. Then I can hear the message. And if it says this is U.S. Treasury or the IRS or somebody, you know, it's a scam call, you just don't have to respond to it at all. But what I have found in doing the research for this book and spending the time writing it is that basically when you look at all these scams, no matter what they are, robocalls or otherwise, they come down to two red flags. And if you understand these red flags, you will probably not get scammed. And the first red flag is that I'm going to tell you that you have to give me money immediately. You have to pay this right now. So either give me a credit card number over the phone, go and tell me where your bank account number is so I can draft on it, or go down to Walmart, get a Green Dot card, call me right back and give me the number on the back of the card. If I had said in the grandparent scam to the police officer, well, you know what, I live just a block from the police station, so why don't I just walk down there right now and give you the $500 bail?
Yeah.
Oh, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
It has to be right now. Mm-hmm. And the second flag is that simply at some point, whether it's a romance scam or I'm saying I'm your bank, I'm going to ask you for personal information. What's your social security number? What's your date of birth? You know, where do you bank? What's your credit card number? Those are the red flags.
Some of these calls take a recording of your picking up the phone and someone saying to you, are you Steve Pomerantz? And you go, yes. They take that yes and they apply it in all nefarious ways. What do they do with that?
Well, yes, and that's happened to my own wife. I mean, that happens to lots of people. And basically, then they turn around and send you a bill for something that you never ordered. And you call the place and you say, look, I never ordered this. Oh, no, actually, we have a recording of you saying, yes, you want it. And then they play this recording and it's your voice saying yes. And then they, you know, if you say, well, look, I'm not doing that, they'll try to threaten you with, I'm going to turn this over to a collection agency. I'm going to let the credit bureau know. I'll turn this over to our attorneys. Those threats you just need to ignore. There's nothing they're going to do. There's nothing they can do. But that's a scare feature of the second part of that scam.
So you should, if someone says, this is your name, you should go, correct.
You could.
I don't know what they're going to do with the word correct.
No.
Well, you know, the other interesting thing was that most of the calls come on Tuesdays and Fridays. Any logic to that?
Most of these calls come out of boiler rooms, and these boiler rooms consist of a lot of people, and they basically, there are certain times of the week that they get better rates on those calls. There's certain times that they think people are more apt to be, the people, whoever their target is, would be more apt to answer the telephone.
Oh, I gotcha.
So it's just based around those kind of things.
My guest is Frank Abagnale. The book is Scam Me If You Can. You may remember the movie Catch Me If You Can. He was the man on which this movie was based. The book is Scam Me If You Can, Simple Strategies to Outsmart Today's Ripoff Artists. Frank, I want to talk about passwords because they're driving me crazy. And, you know, I try to change my passwords and I'm constantly typing them in wrong because they're too long and they contain symbols and numbers. And according to your book, none of that really matters very much. What's the current thinking on the use of passwords? And is there a way to get rid of using passwords?
You know, I wrote many years ago that passwords were for treehouses. Passwords are a 1964 technology. They were developed in 1964. I was 16 years old. I'm 71 now, and we are still using passwords. We know for a fact that approximately 80 to 90% of all the malware, ransomware, is caused by passwords. So absolutely, I've been saying for years that we need to get rid of passwords. It's a very old technology, and happy to say today that there are a couple of different companies now that have come out with the ability to eliminate the use of a password. They identify you by your phone. So there's an ad out that you saw Serena Williams running through a marketplace. She saw a necklace she liked, but she was in a running outfit. But she only had her phone in her hand, so she walked over to the ATM machine. She pressed an app on her phone, and she got her cash, no card, no password. Those types of technologies today are what's taking over the need for passwords and eliminating that need. So I think in the next 2 or 3 years, you will see the major banks and certainly the major retailers and airlines eliminate the need for passwords. But it's funny you say that, because the other day I forgot a password. So when I went online and said I forgot my password, they came back and said, well, tell us the last password you used. I mean, it's kind of just very frustrating. But I think we're going to eliminate the need for passwords very shortly in the near future.
I know in the Apple system and the iOS system, it saves the passwords in a keychain. It's incredibly convenient to have that kind of a service. Does that protect me at all?
My concern about those things is, who is the service? Is the service seven guys in a loft in Denver, Colorado, or is it a multi-million dollar technology company that's keeping those passwords? And then how do I know what that company is doing to keep them from being breached? Just a few days ago, we had a company that keeps 20 million fingerprints and biometrics for companies in Australia, the United Kingdom, and America. These are the companies that when you enter your office building and you show your ID, those companies keep all of that data. And now that 20 million pieces of data in somebody else's hands, so they have access and entry points now and biometrics of 20 million people. So it's only as safe as how good the company is of keeping it safe.
Yeah, how many breaches do you hear about in a given year? I mean, it's constantly these large companies, even the credit companies, the Equifaxes of the world, even they're being breached. If they're being breached, what chance do we have?
I've dealt with many of these breaches, and as I tell agents all the time, that every breach occurs because somebody in that company did something they weren't supposed to do, or somebody in that company failed to do something they were supposed to do. Hackers don't cause breaches. People do. Hackers just look for open doors. And in the case of Equifax, they didn't update their system. They didn't fix their security patches sent to them by Microsoft. So the hacker simply was able to easily get into that open door, sit there for a couple of months and decide what information I want to steal, and stole it. And no matter what breach you look at, that's always the case. So in the case of Capital One, that was Amazon. Someone working at Amazon was able to go up in the cloud, bring down that data, and sell that data. So it always comes down to that individual, that human element of it.
I want to find out more about one of the topics in your book called The Wild World of Dating App Scams. Now, this never occurred to me that this would be an area for people to operate. How do those work?
Yeah, and there are lots of names like catfishing and so on, but so far the romance scams have basically doubled in the last couple of years since I've been writing the book, and they become very common. So one of the ways they do it is they will go to a Facebook page and they will capture the photograph of a young Marine who's very good looking, he's in full uniform, has his medals on his chest, and they then take that photo and they send out thousands of emails to women saying that this is me. And then they get a relationship with them on the phone or through emails. And eventually, after a month or 2 months, they might say, I'm over in Afghanistan, and I wondered if you could send me a gift card with $200 on it because I don't have access to money. Sometimes they're just somebody you meet online. In one case, it was a woman who was involved in a sweepstakes scam from a Jamaican group, and then the guy turned it into a romance scam and took her for a lot more money. And again, I say to someone, look, if you meet someone online, and you have a relationship, you're talking back and forth, they keep you company, you like it because you're alone and you have someone now to talk to and communicate with, that's fine. But at some point that person starts to ask you for money, that's when you have to say to yourself, I don't know this person, I never met this person, I'm not going to send this person money. But that's when you have to wake up. And I remind people today that you can't rely on the police, you can't rely on the bank, you can't rely on the government to protect you. You have to be a smarter consumer. You have to be a wiser business person today than you did 25 years ago. So you have to educate yourself about these things. Otherwise, you will be victimized.
Well, I'm terribly disappointed that all the Russian women that know me by my first name and want to meet me are not real. Is that what you're telling me,
no,
Frank?
They really want your money. They don't want you.
Okay. All right. Finally, let's talk about charity scammers, and we'll wrap it up with that. These are scammers that pull on your heartstrings. Again, we were talking about, you know, some of these hitting these buttons, the urgency, the flattery. Give us one quick story there.
Especially like the GoFundMe, and we had the couple that joined in with the guy that was homeless, and it was all a scam, and they got $400,000 from people who felt sorry for them, and that was all a scam. And we're getting ready to have election time, and there'll be all these scams about donate money to my campaign, which is not really the person that you're donating the money to.
Right.
What I tell people I find is the simplest way to deal with that, if you're approached by a charity you're not familiar with, is to contact your state attorney general's office, because your state attorney general is the best source, because they're elected by you, and he or she has an enormous staff that deals with consumer crimes. And they're very educated. They're very good. I've worked with all 50 of them. Basically, they're able to tell you this is a legitimate charity. It's not a legitimate charity. They will look into it if they don't know about it, and they will get back to you about it. But before you part with your money, make sure that you know that you're giving it to a legitimate source for a legitimate reason. And there's ways to verify and check that out.
My guest, Frank Abagnale. The book is Scam Me If You Can, Simple Strategies to Outsmart Today's Ripoff Artists. Frank, how do people get this book?
It's available on Amazon or, of course, in any of the bookstores. It's published by Random House, and it's my fifth book, but it's all the books previous to that have been about commercial crimes. So this is the first time I really looked at consumer crimes, and I tried to do it so that it just basically educates people and comes back as a reference book if they ever need to look something up to see how that scam is working in case they're in the middle of being scammed.
It's a good read. Again, the name of the book is Scam Me If You Can, Simple Strategies to Outsmart Today's Ripoff Artists. And to hear this in any interview, again, just go to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. We love your questions. We love the back and forth that it provides us to hear what you think of the show and to answer any questions that you may have. While you're there, also sign up for our weekly update for upcoming live events and the important topics we've covered this week straight into your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. Frank, thanks again.
Thank you, Steve.
Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes made of ticky-tacky. Little boxes on the hillside. Little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one, and a blue one, and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
I once had a client that lived in an apartment building on the beach in Boca.
Okay.
On the beach in Boca. Right?
Yep.
Okay.
I got the picture.
And he went to sell it. And there was an agent who lived in that building that specialized in that one building.
Yep.
And I was like, well, why don't you just go get a really great agent? He goes, no, this guy knows this building really well.
Okay.
And, you know, I think it made sense to me at the time. Now, how much of an agent's life and career is based on this extreme local knowledge?
You know, if you're dealing with an agent who's good, they become super hyper local in their communities. And a good agent really needs to know their numbers. A good agent knows what's coming on the market before it even comes on the market, because they've either been interviewed, they hear the buzz, they're walking the streets. They have an idea. They're talking to other realtors. Realtors talk.
Yeah.
So to deal with an agent who really knows the area, I think it's critical. And in many ways, for example, when it comes to negotiating, okay, and depending on what side you're on, but let's say you're working for the seller. Well, your agent most likely has been in the other homes that sold and may have sold them themselves. So when it comes to negotiating and the other agent comes into town who doesn't know the community, doesn't know the area, they're going to have to listen to what that agent tells them. Not only that, then comes the part of the appraiser. So the appraiser tends to rely on local agents when they're doing their appraisals. So they're going to be asking the questions of those agents that are very familiar with the community about the properties. So it's really to your advantage to use an agent who's very seasoned and has the experience and knows the numbers.
So it's not really just a question of, you know, good advertisement. I mean, how many flyers do we get in the mail? It's, you know, anybody with a license can sell a house.
Sure.
But there's more to selling a house than just having a license. As a matter of fact, you were telling me off air of a story. I think it involved your brother and so on.
Yes, or somebody's brother. So
somebody's brother.
You know, situation basically is they want to hire me, but then they're like, you know, we have our brother who lives 40 miles away.
Oh, that, yeah, oh, yeah.
He wants to sell it for us.
Yeah, so you want to kind of throw the brother some business or the brother-in-law.
Which is a nice gesture, but is he really the best hire?
Yeah.
Does he really know the numbers?
Yeah.
You know, just in negotiating alone, an agent can make a 4% spread difference in their negotiating skills, especially if they have the knowledge.
Right.
Of that particular marketplace.
When I was looking for a house when we were moving to Delray, I mean, I really felt sorry for the agent. We drove him crazy, but he was so patient with us. And actually, the house we ended up buying was one which had not come on the market yet. It was just this agent had local knowledge. And she told the person who was representing me, and we went in to see it.
Yep.
And that was
that happens
one.
All the time. I know of properties that are coming on the market, and the first people I bring it to the attention to are my clients.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I sell homes before they even hit the market. So that's why when you see these days on market, maybe one day, a lot of times that was because the deal was put together before even you saw it on the MLS, multiple listing service.
Yeah. What about talking about buying and selling homes? What about dealing with the appliances? I know that can be a sticky situation.
Sure.
Give us some stories about that.
So when you have a contract, you want to make sure you write down all the appliances that you want to remain. See, here in Florida, it has all the appliances listed, but it doesn't have washer dryer. The agent has to handwrite washer dryer. Don't ask me why, but that's the default.
Okay.
So I recently had a situation where the seller asked, hey, can we keep our washer dryer? But this is before contract. And like, yeah, we can not include it in a contract. Not a problem. So when it came to negotiating in Florida, it's generally perceived that the washer dryer stay. So the buyer came in, wanted the washer dryer. As a matter of fact, I showed them the washer dryer because they were really nice washer dryers. However, their agent failed to put it in the contract. So the seller took it upon himself, looked at the contract and said, oh, they must not want the washer dryer. I'm going to get rid of them.
That's fair.
Which is fair. So he sold them. And these were like, one was a really expensive brand new, like a year old washer
Like these
machine.
Little aircraft
like fancy
carriers.
Ones. Yes, know. This real fancy dancy one. Sold them for $600.
Yeah.
So I get to the closing table. The buyer's furious.
Yeah.
They expected them to stay. Mm-hmm. The seller feels bad because, you know, he thought he did them a favor by getting rid of them.
Yeah.
He sold them for $600, right? So, you know, the buyer's looking for compensation. Of course, the buyer wants the full amount. Mm-hmm. What would a new washer dryer cost?
Yeah.
So basically, I brought it down to the smallest dollar amount, which is how much is a used washer dryer really worth?
And you had a number because
had a number because the seller sold them for $600.
Yeah.
So instead of having a $4,000 problem, we brought it down to a $600 problem.
Yeah.
And we just made it right.
Unfortunately for the buyer, they really want a $2,000.
Right. I feel bad. You know, the problem would have been, there would not have been an issue if it was in writing. That's the whole thing.
That's the moral of the story.
Yeah. So make sure all the appliances are written in the contract. Don't assume because somebody said that they're included, that they're actually included. And that's for anything that's considered personal property.
Okay.
Light fixtures, all of that.
Yeah. Ceiling fans.
Ceiling fans, fancy ceiling fans, you know. Ask, are there any exclusions?
Yeah.
And same, sellers, if you have an exclusion, make sure it's very clear in the contract. Dining room chandelier excluded.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you run into this situation. Yeah. It doesn't happen that often. Oh, refrigerators, garage refrigerators. Yeah. Oh, I can't tell you how many times we fight over the garage refrigerator.
I believe that, by the way.
Yeah.
I believe that. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Well, I am thrilled to have my next guest back on the airwaves. This is the gentleman who I don't think we've spoken to in a few years. He is the longest-serving paid contributor on CNBC. He's an American author of 3 books, A Million Is Not Enough, How to Retire with the Money You'll Need, book number 1, book number 2, The Arrogance Cycle, and number 3, Restoring Our American Dream, which came out in 2013. And he is the one and only Michael Farr, and his company is Farr Miller in Washington, located in Washington, D.C. Michael Farr, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Steve, very much. It's a great pleasure to be back with you. I've missed you guys.
Ah, we missed you too. I don't know why it's taken so long, but that's water under the bridge.
Perfect.
We'll look towards the future. You know, you've been writing a lot, as you always do, and there were a couple of articles that caught my attention, and one of which was this idea about let's not talk ourselves into a recession. What does that actually mean? How do you talk yourself into a recession?
I hope that it's a hard thing to do, but it's not certainly an impossible thing to do. You know, recessions are periods of where we actually go negative on growth and the economy actually starts to shrink. It's not just slower growth. And when you get these down days in the markets and they bring all the talking heads on TV and we all start talking about the worries about slowing growth out of China and, you know, whether we're going to be able to continue to see GDP growth and all of the other problems that we face around the world, we can kind of create enough of a negative scenario that we start our own soundtrack, right? Mm-hmm. And we listen to it enough on radio and we start to quote each other in different reports. And then CEOs who are thinking about investing in new plant and equipment and new jobs don't really know why they're going to hold off, but their gut starts to tell them to hold off. Mm-hmm. And I think largely it can happen because we've created the clouds on the horizon and left them hanging there when maybe they really aren't there at all.
You know, it reminds me of this phenomenon we see sometimes with an individual, the stock price of an individual company. So if the stock price is high or hitting new highs, you know, one tends to think, oh, this company is great. But if there's a hiccup and you start to see the price go down and maybe it's just, you know, it's languished for 6 months or something, you automatically get the perception that this company is not so great anymore. And sometimes you think it's actually bad. And the stock price is really just the stock price. It's not really a true reflection of the business necessarily. And if we start talking about things like inverted yield curves, and especially that has been a big one, the trade war with China, all these worries start to come to mind. Psychologically, the market might sell off or experience a correction. And then, you know, the big news outlets to sell advertising, or as we used to say, you know, in the newspaper business, it's, you know, when it bleeds, it leads.
Yep.
The negativity is something that attracts people, attracts eyeballs. and they sell more advertising. So now everybody starts talking about recession, and then everybody starts to get depressed, and investor confidence wanes and consumer confidence. Isn't that what kind of we're talking about here?
Well, it is. And I think, you know, when you talk to an economist or you talk to the folks at the Federal Reserve or central bankers around the world, when they look at something like inflation, they look not only at the inflation data, but they place an equal weight on the expectations for inflation,
mm-hmm.
for what people think is going to happen. Because
yeah.
if people think that prices are going to go down, they stop spending.
Yeah.
I mean, wallets stay in the pocket. They
yeah.
can be very patient waiting for those lower prices.
Right.
And that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So those expectations for inflation or not inflation or economic growth or not economic growth really are very important. And I think you hit on a key point that, you know, we have to be aware of our own rhetoric, of our own messaging, and that, you know, we don't start that negative feedback loop, not only for ourselves, but for the economy.
I remember in the early 80s when interest rates were so high and inflation was high and rising, inflation, there was a self-reinforcing cycle with inflation. As things went up in price, people were buying now in anticipation of higher prices later. So there was buying demand, which outstripped supply, which created higher inflation, which created higher interest rates. Right now, we're really kind of talking about the opposite. If things are negative and the expectation for prices are down, then people are going to wait, which exacerbates the problem even more. But, you know, you said in your recent article that it's not only about what's happening right now, and it's especially now, you know, we get these metrics that are published every single month from the Fed and the Bureau of Labor Statistics and all of this, and that's kind of old news. It's not where we are right now, but it's the foreseeable change in the future that's going to determine whether, in fact, we are going to get a recession. You use an example of unemployment right now, this low unemployment. How would a rate of change either way affect our vision of whether we're going to have a recession or not in the next 6 to 12 months?
Over the past few years, we've seen unemployment fall dramatically, which means we've, of course, seen employment, number of people employed, rise dramatically. And you get used to seeing these numbers, you know, of we've added 200,000 jobs last month, we've added 200,000 jobs this month, we're going to add 200. And then all of a sudden, you know, we get to be 3.6 or 3.7% unemployed. And when you're 3.6 or 3.7% unemployed, you know, you're 96.3 or 96.4% employed. Well, if you're 96.3% of anything,
mm-hmm.
I mean, how much more can you add and how quickly? And sooner or later, you can't just keep adding 200,000 more jobs a month. There aren't any people left. You got 96.3 or 96.4 of them. I mean, you're not going to add that many more of them. They just aren't out there to be added to the workforce. So at some point, you've got to get used to seeing those numbers plateau.
Right.
And they could stay that way for a while, but all of a sudden a plateauing number, if we're not careful, can represent a disappointment. And we've actually started to see that as some of the economic data and employment data have been released, that people say, well, we didn't add as many jobs last month. Number of jobs added really are tapering off. Well, of course they're tapering off. I mean, we've really gone beyond full employment. We have more job openings. Then we've got people looking for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so it doesn't mean that it's awful, but we've just got to make sure that we don't start seeing it as awful or start seeing it as something that's negative when it really isn't.
So if it's the rate of change and we can suspect that the future rate of change is not going to necessarily mean more or accelerating employment, then maybe we just have, you know, kind of a stable 4% unemployment rate. You know, don't forget there's millions of baby boomers that are retiring every single year as well. So they're coming out of the system as well, which is, I guess, creating some constraints as well. So can we not go into recession if unemployment or employment plateaus?
Yeah, we can. We absolutely can, because you have that huge workforce and almost the entire workforce is working and producing and generating, you know, economic growth. Now, what we need to see at some point, and this, it is an issue, we have to see a growing workforce. I mean, we do need to see more people out there working. One of the ways you look at GDP growth is to take the growth in your workforce plus productivity. And that is a definition of GDP growth. So growth in your workforce. Mm-hmm. Think of it as a donut shop. I've got three people coming in to make donuts every morning. They show up at 4:30 every morning. God help those poor people who have to show up at 4:30 to make those donuts.
I agree.
But I've got my three people who come in and work on three machines. And to figure out, you know, the productivity growth of my donut shop, pretty much an economist is going to say, if I add a fourth person, I should have more donuts. If I add a fourth machine, I should have more donuts. If I add both, I should have a lot more donuts. In the U.S. right now, and this is half of the equation, because this is the supply side of the equation, not the demand side of the equation. But in the U.S. right now, population growth is as low as it's ever been. Historically, when an economist wants to figure out how an economy is doing around the globe, you pick the country and we'll say, how is their economy doing? The first question an economist typically asks is, what's happening to their population growth? Because a growing population typically has a positive economy and positive economic growth.
Yeah.
Ours is stalling 0.4% in population growth from U.S. babies being born as United States citizens. So if you want to grow your workforce, you then have to rely on immigration. And there has been political pressure on immigration.
Right.
So we have some headwinds to growth as we look at the GDP growth formula. But it doesn't mean, even though it's going to be, we can see where it's going to be slow and we can see where there are pressures on forward growth, it doesn't mean that where we are is necessarily awful at all. I mean, we've come a long way. When you look at where we were in 2008 and 2009, even in the stock market, that was we're up almost 20,000 points from the lows just in 2009.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an amazing return. And if we're going to have this economic recovery over that same 10-year period and growth slows at the end of that, man, that's not bad. I'll take that. That's okay. We can grow slowly from these high numbers.
You know, Michael, I want to talk about interest rates because when, again, you know, going back years and years when I was first became an advisor, as I said before, interest rates were rising. So rising interest rates were for the economy were a bad thing and falling interest rates were a good thing. And yet in this kind of upside down world, we have this falling interest rates and everybody is miserable. They're all worried that this means, you know, you can't get a break as an advisor. I can tell you that. You just can't get a break,
right?
You know?
Well, yeah. And, you know, falling interest rates too, one of the implications, the bad implications for falling interest rates is there's not enough demand for money. It's just the supply and demand. So if you and I and 10 of our best friends went to a bank to buy basically for the same loan, the bank might at some point say, well, wait a minute, everybody's standing outside for a loan. We're going to charge a little bit more for it.
Right.
And we might say, Steve and I might say, okay, we've got such wonderful prospects for this business that we're going to start on this borrowed money. We're going to pay them a little bit more because we're so optimistic.
Right.
So this idea of lower rates is if people aren't willing to go borrow the money when it's this cheap, then maybe they don't have any real, and it comes back to the attitude largely again, but they don't have any great idea for how they can make more money than, you know, the 3% that the bank's going to charge them. And that begins that negative feedback loop too.
But Michael, I feel that these lower interest rates to a large degree are a function of the need for this large amount, I mean, trillions of dollars that are floating around the world to find a safe home, especially if the stock market gets a little funky, that money has got to go somewhere. And it goes into U.S. treasuries, which drives up prices and drives down yields. So is it really a lack of demand or is it somehow on the other side of the table where the forces lie?
Certainly there's a supply of dollars. And in the global, you know, rate neighborhood, we are one of the most attractive houses out there. Germany has negative rates. Japan has negative rates. And of course, Steve, for all the years, for all of the decades that I've been doing this, and as much as I understand negative interest rates on paper, I still don't get them. I'm going to give my money to the government of Germany for a 10-year note with a basically contract to receive back less, to pay them to hold my money every year and give me guaranteed back less money at the end of 10 years. I mean, that's mind-boggling, and people are lining up to do it.
Well, Michael, I want a mortgage. where I get a reduction. Instead of me sending principal every month, I actually have the bank reducing my principal every month because they're paying
me. I think it's a fabulous, get me, you know, I would take, let's go, if any bankers are listening, Pomerantz and Farr are customers right now.
That's right.
The answer is yes.
Yeah, I got some money.
Negative rates.
That's
whenever
right.
You're ready.
I'll lend you money any day if I don't have to pay you. You pay me for the right of me borrowing money from you. It's insane. So, you know, unfortunately, we only have a minute and change left. I guess the getting back to the original idea or question or thesis here, do you see a recession on the horizon right now?
Not on the immediate horizon, I don't. I do see some signs that are worrisome, but, you know, we haven't had a recession for 10 years. Are we going to have another recession? Sure, we're going to have another recession.
Yeah.
When? I don't know. It doesn't look like it's going to be any time in the next 12 months. I'd be amazed if we didn't see it in the next 5 years.
I don't know where else to put money if 10-year interest rates are at 1.5% and everything else is so low. With the low interest rates, asset prices rise and companies are earning a higher return on their investments than 1.5%. It still seems like the stock market is the right place. You agree or disagree?
I do agree. I do think you need to try and stay out of the thin branches of risk. And I think that there are still a lot of the value stocks that have underperformed for the past few years with great balance sheets and decent dividends. And if you can get yourself 4-5% a year earnings growth and a 2% dividend and a 7% return in this environment, I think I'd be very happy with that for a long time.
Quality, quality, quality. It's like real estate, right? Location, location, location. This is for right now. Quality is the key. Michael Farr, CNBC contributor, as always, a stimulating discussion with you. And I thank you so much for joining us.
I get to join this quality Steve Pomerantz. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Michael. And to hear this in any interview again, or if you have a question about what we've just discussed, visit our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. No T in Pomerantz. Just go straight to the Z after the N. stevepomerantz.com to join the conversation. While you're there, sign up for our weekly update. We will send you into your inbox all the segments that we do that week in transcript form and summary form, and you can also hear them as well. That's stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.